From the Bartlett Center for Advanced Spatial Analysis at UCL, you're listening to The Global Lab. Our theme for this episode is seeing cities. We'll be hearing about two very different ways of looking at a city, making connections across space and time, and allowing us to understand the urban environment and its history in new and unexpected ways. Duncan Hay visited Queen Mary University to talk to two art historians whose work is bound up with these issues. Later on, we'll hear from Emily Oleron Evans on the unique perspective that the art and architectural historian Nikolaus Pefsner brought to the buildings of England. First, though, Duncan talks to Hannah Williams to understand how digital mapping has allowed her to unearth surprising patterns in the art world of 18th century Paris.
My name is Hannah Williams, and I am a Leverhulme Early Career Research Fellow here at Queen Mary. And I'm an art historian. I'm a specialist of the 18th century, and I work a little bit on the 17th and the 19th centuries as well, but I'm an early modernist. And I've been working on a project called Artists in Paris, Mapping the 18th Century Art World. And it's an attempt to use GIS and digital mapping technologies to trace a different kind of history of the 18th century art world that really puts the city at the centre of that history in a way that hasn't really happened before.
And what sort of questions does the technology allow you to ask, and do these questions come out of the technology?
I think it's the technology is in a way the means to an end, and in a way an inspiration to different research questions. So it's a bit of both. I can't really disentangle the technology from a much more urban history spatial approach more generally, and other sort of methods and approaches that come from that. That different discipline, but it's really about thinking a bit more, something a bit more about trends over time, and a bit more about artists as agents rather than as sort of makers of objects. Really thinking about them as people inhabiting a space, and the role that the space, and particularly urban space and neighbourhoods and streets and apartment buildings, comes to play a social role in their art practices and in their social networks and in their being able to kind of acquire sort of supplies or other sort of things that we don't normally necessarily think of as art historians. We're very focused on sort of what takes place within the frame of the artwork and sometimes a bit less about the things in the world that connect the objects and the people. So I've got this sort of website that I've created has this kind of contemporary base map and then geo-referenced 18th century maps of the city on top of that, and then coloured markers that represent each artist sort of plotted, the location of their studios are sort of plotted on the map. So for me, I know Paris very well as a city, and I've come to think about it in a very different way from doing this project, but it's really been about thinking, sort of translating in my mind and then onto the screen these real and represented spaces. There's something about having the layers of the maps on as the kind of the virtual material of the project really makes you think about the relationship between past and present, and how past and present are connected by space. That there are these markers that drop through layers of maps that are also sort of staking a point in the city where something happened in the past, and you can still be on that point in the city now. And so it's sort of, it's proof of the project in a way, but for me it's been one of the most evocative parts of the actual doing of the project.
As you map where these artists have lived, is that something that, is that giving you a new way into their work, or?
Not into one aspect of their works, which is to do with the origins of what we think of as a really kind of Parisian genre of painting, which is the kind of the cityscape, like this very sort of, mostly with the Impressionists. You'd think it would sort of begin, and this engagement with the city as a space for representation. But I guess what the most interesting kind of takeaway in terms of the neighbourhoods that they're living in is a kind of century, across the century, there's this real gravitation towards the Louvre. The Louvre becomes the primary neighbourhood. The Louvre has a very interesting history in the 18th century because it's not no longer really a royal palace, but it's not yet a museum until the Revolution. So when Louis XIV moves the French courts of Versailles in 1682, the palace is sort of left. He really didn't like the Louvre as a space. He had bad connotations from his childhood there. And so it gets sort of abandoned and it gets left to he sort of installs his Royal Academies of the Académie Française, the Royal Academy of Painting and Sculpture, Architecture and Science, all get kind of moved into the palace, and it becomes a kind of cultural forum, but it also becomes this space, and has been for a century already actually, where artists have studios, but there weren't that many until the 18th century, when loads more are given studios, lots more of the palace is taken over, and the artists who aren't given studios in the palace gravitate to the streets and the neighbourhood around it, and so the Louvre, not as a building but as a quartier, as a neighbourhood, becomes the kind of artistic centre of Paris. And I think, given what the more general history we have of Paris, we think of the most artistic neighbourhoods being places like Montmartre or Montparnasse, so much more 19th, 20th century artistic community spaces. So it was really interesting to think about. Obviously, the Louvre already has artistic connotations, but not really in that more social way. So it was really interesting to think about this, the different artistic histories of that space in the city. This now kind of museological artistic history, but has already had a much longer social art history in a way.
It's almost like a reverse gentrification going on. A really familiar pattern in the contemporary city is that artists are like the shock troops of gentrification. Yes. So an area's cheap, the creatives move in because it's cheap, and then all of a sudden it's a fashionable place to live. I mean, I'm just thinking about Hackney Wick, for example. Like, what are the economics of this?
I guess that's really interesting because the artists who I've been looking at in this project they're all members of the Royal Academy. So they're already artists who are, they're not all necessarily rich, but they're all kind of Paris's elite. So before you have artists being basically the avant-garde and having that role of coming from below to that this is actually not reverse gentrification, but a different social spectrum. And what's been difficult with this project is that it would have been wonderful to be able to map not just these elite artists, but other artists. So there's another big important institution in this period, which is the Guild. And it's just that usually sort of the Academy is sort of thought of as the elite, and the Guild's much larger institutions sort of thought of people who would rather be in the Academy but haven't quite yet made it. But I did do it. They didn't keep their archives, their records in the same way, so it wasn't possible to do a mapping across the centuries. I was able to with the Academy, but there is a record for 1 year of the Guild's addresses. So I've been able to do a kind of comparison for 1 year, and the Guild artists and the Academy artists are actually much more integrated than we would have thought, or than I would have thought. I would have thought they'd been quite separate social communities. We always think of them as really separate separate artistic spheres. But in terms of where they're living in the city, there's a lot more, you know, cross-fertilisation, a lot more, I can imagine there are, you know, a lot more interaction in the streets. There are Academy artists who are living in more guild-centric areas, and there are lots of Guild artists who are living around the Louvre as well, so a lot more artistic exchange was going on between those artistic communities, I think. Well, that's what this, you know, this mapping of the communities would suggest. So this is what the mapping project has done is kind of, is what I was saying before about it's raised more questions than I had at the beginning of the project. It was, the question I had at the beginning was, where were artists living in 18th century Paris? We know all about where they were living in the 19th and 20th centuries, but how were these earlier generations of artists inhabiting the city? And now it's led into these much more granular questions. But we have some data. We need to kind of put meat on these bones and flesh out the stories around these little dots on maps and find out the personal stories behind those dots.
And in terms of continuities between the 18th and the 19th and 20th centuries, have you been able to pick out where the artistic centre of gravity has moved?
As it moves into the 19th century?
Yeah, yeah.
There's one artist in particular who's... Because for the most part, you've got a city that's expanding between the beginning of my maps of the extent of the city is the inner ring of boulevards, and by the end of the period that the map covers, it's the outer ring of boulevards. So it expands a lot, but this is a community that's contracting because they're all the general trend is that they're moving in towards the Louvre. But there are a few who, towards the end of the century, start to move out. And one of the interesting artists called Jean-Baptiste Pigalle, who's a sculptor, and he lives in the Louvre for most of his career, so in one of these elite studios. But towards the end of his career, he gets married for the first time, and he buys a property way up in the north, the base of the Butte de Montmartre. And so he has a big property, and his property extends all the way up to the walls of the city. And that's the one place in the city I've found where there is a sort of now a kind of a material trace in that there's a street that he lived on that is called Rue Jean-Baptiste Pigalle. There's a metro station called Pigalle. It's the whole quartier is known as Pigalle. It's a very famous kind of red light district now, but it's also where the kind of the origins of the modernist artistic community developed, and lots of modern artists, Thomas Couture, Claude Monet, and Bonnard as well, all actually lived at certain points or had studios on Rue Jean-Baptiste Pigalle. So there's this lovely kind of point of connection, I guess, between this modernist art world that we know so much better and this sort of older art world that actually has a real physical, spatial intersection of that strange point in the city, the red light district.
And is it the revolution is that a break?
Yes, the revolution and everything that came with it, the undoing of social and political institutions and structures. And one of the things that happened with the revolution is that the academy, the Royal Academy, is disbanded, and so all these sort of royal institutions, state institutions that used to provide status to artists are gone, and artists need to reinvent a way of being an artist and to do it quite quickly, and a lot of that comes from that particular moment at the very beginning of the 19th century. I mean, in some ways, the revolution did create a huge break, but some of the more interesting things to look at are the things that continued across that. And unfortunately for the project that I worked on, the records stopped because the institution stopped, so I couldn't continue it beyond. But you know, people don't just cease to exist in 1793 when the Academy, they all go on and live. And it would be really interesting, kind of the kind of the next stage of this project that I really want to do is to look at what happens to a lot of those people, maybe not doing all of them, but sort of following a few of them through the city and looking at when they're chucked out of the Louvre in 1805, where do the new studios go, where in the early 19th century, before Montmartre becomes the hub, how does the Louvre become Montmartre? How does that community get there? And is it a direct path, or what permutations are followed on the way there?
Nikolaus Pevsner came to Britain from Germany in the 1930s and proceeded to revolutionize the field of art history. He's best remembered for his series of architectural guides, The Buildings of England, a forensically detailed commentary on England's architecture, compiled from almost 30 years of travels across the country. Duncan talks to modern-day art historian Emily Oleron Evans to discover what made Pevsner's perspective so special.
My name is Émilie Oléron-Evans. I'm a lecturer in French here at Queen Mary in the Department of Modern Languages and Cultures. And my work is on art history, the history of the discipline of art history, and visual culture in general. And I've worked on Nikolaus Pevsner's work here in the UK and the transfers of his ideas, because he was born and trained in Germany. So he transferred his way of thinking, his work, his life in the UK, and had to reinvent himself. He's most famous, I think, these days for his guidebooks across the counties of England, the buildings of England. An ongoing series with Yale Press. They are now called the Pevsner Architectural Guides. And actually, he can be credited, I think, without overstating it, for bringing into the English psyche the notion of space as applied to architecture. So not a history of architecture as a history of periods and movements and styles, although he's full of contradictions and very complex, so you have to excuse me, but if we put aside what he's most famous for, which is the concept of Zeitgeist, which is every style echoes an era, and it's such a fully fleshed concept that it entered the language. People say Zeitgeist even in English now, a bit like Schadenfreude, you don't need to translate. So he's famous for that, but actually he also, more subtly maybe, through his writings on architecture, introduced people to the idea that they can experience their architectural environment through the common denominator that is space. Everybody has a body through which they experience their environment, and your measure of everything is your own body, you're standing in a place, you're moving around it. And that's why his writing is really dynamic. When you read a chapter on a cathedral, it won't be dividing it into the traditional first the facade and then we go in, etc. It will also be when you enter the place, so the concept of the contrast between the bright daylight outside and then you enter in the shade and you have to accommodate your eye, he takes that into account, and it's very much you walk with him through, and you walk around the buildings with him. And that's I think that also meets with what Hannah was saying about the social nature of or this aspect of a universal history of art that everybody can encounter and experience without necessarily a very highly technical background or education. Mm. You can experience every single building around you just through walking in it and around it.
My immediate reaction to that was that if you're looking at a picture or you're listening to music or you're reading a book, there's an active process of decoding. Whilst with architecture, you experience it in use. And I guess I'm quite interested in what that relationship between the spatial experience and the written text is.
It comes across very regularly in scholarship about Pevsner's architectural texts, that they are one of a kind. There's a funny anecdote by one of his students called Raina Banham, who went to study American architecture, objects of the everyday, the designs of cars, etc., and still being as an historian of architecture. And as a student reading Pevsner's book on architecture called An Outline of European Architecture that came out in 1942, he says he was so engrossed in reading a passage on a church called Viertenheiligen, a German Baroque church, that he missed his bus. That's how compelling and engaging, and you call it, he uses onomatopoeias like pop whiz kind of literature, which is a welcome change from the traditional way of writing about buildings. So there is this dynamic in the text, the energy that you see flowing in a building, you also, he managed to capture it through, he uses lots of verbs of movements. And actually in a more pragmatic way, when you read one of the volumes of The Buildings of England, you have these descriptions of buildings, but they also follow the route of the streets. And there's a smaller chapter at the end of each, for London it would be each borough, for instance, for each zone, where you have something called perambulation. So you're supposed to go with your nose in the book and then looking up, nose in book again, and this movement of to and fro between the text and the space is a very idiosyncratic way of experiencing architecture that Pevsner implemented. I think that's what makes its success since, because there are loads of guidebooks out there. But it's, in a way, it's a little bit like an app. like you.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah. Well, it's actually almost like a podcast that you're often trying to find ways through one medium to convey another. And art historians have always had this problem, particularly in print context where you can't print images or you can only print black and white images. You're trying to use ekphrasis to use words to describe images. And in this case, maybe even harder, use words to describe space, which is more multidimensional, even more difficult. He does find this amazing language to do that.
And I think his intention was to make it more democratic. So he worked as an editor for the Architectural Review from the 1940s onwards. And one of the first series he wrote, it was actually anonymous, but then he revealed a few years later that it was his, were this kind of promenades, so walking around, and one of them was London. Anne Hulch studied these articles, focusing on the fact that there were uninteresting buildings, so that you wouldn't choose to exemplify a style or a period. They were just the buildings, the Victorian houses you walk by when you are on Liverpool Street, for instance. But he kind of awoke people's consciousness to the fact that when they're on their commute from work to their house or the other way around, they could experience buildings, they could actually look up and notice a detail, a frieze or whatever, a window, and enjoy it. So it's a way to embellish the everyday life, the everyday walking around the city, and making it your own as well. You're not just one of these many people in the crowd who just mechanically go from A to B. You're it's also part of your life, and I call it democratic because in this particular series of articles, as Anne demonstrates very well, you see that you don't need the knowledge. He kind of infuses it, Pfaffner infuses it little by little, so as long as you read them thoroughly, you might end up with some baggage, but at the beginning you can just stroll around and take it in.
One thing that I find very problematic about the smartphone maps is that, I mean, if I go onto Google Maps and I'm logged in and I look at London, and you do the same thing, we'll see different Londons because it will have algorithmically selected things that it thinks we will be interested in.
Mm. And do you mean that you want like a semantic Pevsner? That you're being shown aspects particularly for you?
Yeah.
Yes. it inspires me the very short answer that it's not possible because it's very much his London, he's this and that county that he describes. He selects, is both trying to be comprehensive and go through each geographical area and measure it. He's the guy measuring the space, arpenteur we say in French, and he selects by category, so it's divided into churches, public spaces, and then the walks that I mentioned. It's structured in eras as well, and it's not an objective commentary on the buildings, far from it. You have his little peak, places that he doesn't like, and yes, he uses the English language with a lot of finesse. So it would be, it's a companion, a bit like Hannah was describing. I think it works very well. The idea of somebody talking to you about their experience of the building. So he kind of steps back in a way and lets you experience it, but he would really appreciate if you took his opinion into account of the same. It's very, very idiosyncratic. And it's got its mark through and through over the 50 volumes and the 20 odd years that he did that every summer. Can you imagine? And he couldn't drive for the beginning, so his wife would drive him, or people assisting him would drive him around, and they would go all day. He had days of visiting each and every parish with old churches and buildings, and then going home to a hotel or a B&B, writing up everything that he had taken notes about throughout the evening until very late at night, and then going off again in the morning.
that makes sense, because it's such an embodied experience that he offers you in these guides. It's not really a guide to the place, it's a guide to his experience of the place on that on that day.
So it would be a very niche app.
Well, the guides are not niche guides, and it's not people do buy them partly from an interest in Hevsner and his approach to architecture and space, but also as guidebooks to the to give you a way of a different way of accessing a building or a place that they have a value. I think that the app would also have a value for the same reason.
But I think the fact that he gives his opinion. He had more freedom in such a format as you would have in a book, in an academic book. So he took this liberty to be part historian, part critic. And I think that's a fine balance, but when you meet it, then you can both teach people facts, but also teach them how to see things. And that's very important to be able to develop your own opinion. And to know that you're not supposed to like something just because somebody calls it a masterpiece of architecture or painting, what have you.
And do you think that's come right back to where we started? Is that something that's easier with architecture than maybe it is with painting?
Because painting as a historical object basically gets put into a museum or becomes a kind of relic of the moment that it was made, whereas architecture has this ongoing life that is lived in constantly in new ways and by new people and new generations, and has to have a kind of a lived experience in the way that painting gets kind of frozen. Yeah, I think so.
I agree. Yes, and also maybe because it's in your space, because you come across it. Whereas you have to walk into the museum to see a painting, so you already do the gesture of, okay, I'm willing to encounter this painting, so it must be that I have some interest, whereas you can just walk across the city and then bump into the Barbican and think, what is that? And I know quite a few Londoners who have a hatred in their guts for that brutalist building, which
it's a heroic failure is what the Barbican is. Yes. I love it.
It's a heroic failed gash through the centre of the city.
But throughout these negative rejection of the Barbican, it's now an icon of the city as much as the London Eye or older buildings, obviously.
But,
or the, I think one that you can see very well the similar process is the Royal Festival Hall, and the spirit of showing we can rebuild the city and build a new future during the Festival of Britain, and now it's also like one of the most thriving space in London, but for a bit. It was hit and miss its future, and the architecture itself, I think, is respected but not really loved or revered as can be more historical buildings or older buildings. It's the older they get, the easier it is to appreciate them. Or if they stood the test of time, they must be good.
Yeah.
They become retro.
Yes.
Yeah.
Vintage.
Like nostalgia is very, very powerful thing. Mm.
That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening to The Global Lab. Our guests were Hannah Williams and Emily Oleron-Evans, so thanks to them also. The interviewer was Duncan Hay, the editor was Thomas Oleron-Evans, and I'm Sarah Wise. You can follow us on Twitter at The Global Lab, all one word. Do get in touch with us and tell us what you think of the show. You can also have a look at our SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/the-global-lab, where you'll find lots of links related to our guests. And subscribe to The Global Lab on iTunes.